for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. There's one more hurdle for proponents of the Keystone XL pipeline: approval from the Department of State. The proposed 1,700-mile project would bring crude oil from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. But many remain concerned about the environmental risks. For this month's Environmental Outlook, joining me here in the studio, Michael Bruhn of the Sierra Club, Matthew Cook of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and Coral Davenport of National Journal. They'll talk about the political, environmental, and economic implications of the Keystone XL pipeline. I invite you to join us. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Coral Davenport, we've talked about this project before. It's been around for a long time. Now it comes down to Secretary of State John Kerry. Give us a little of the background on it and why it comes to the Department of State.
So the Keystone Pipeline, the project of the Keystone Pipeline, has been in the works for nearly 5 years. The project is, as you said, a 1,700-mile pipeline that would begin in the Alberta tar sands of Canada and go down to the Gulf Coast, to the refineries of the Gulf Coast. And ultimate approval for the pipeline goes to the State Department because it crosses international borders. And the question that the Secretary of State will have to answer is this pipeline in the national interest? And this comes down, there's two sides of this debate. On one side is an economic and international trade question. Is it in the interests of the nation's economic health to import this oil, to bring this oil into the U.S., to have access to it, and also to use U.S. refineries and U.S. ports to export it? And is it also in the U.S. interest? You know, this is something that enhances our relationship with Canada, which is our biggest source of foreign oil. On the other side, environmentalists are very, very fearful of this. There's strong environmental opposition to this for a couple of reasons. The first is that the tar sands oil is very carbon intensive. The process used to extract that tar sands oil produces up to 30% more carbon emissions than standard oil. Standard oil, petroleum, is already a major source of carbon greenhouse gas pollution. The tar sands oil would increase carbon pollution even more. So
why does that happen?
The process, the way the oil is in the ground, it's the description tar sands, it's literally oil that is in sand, and the process used to get it out, it's this sticky sandy oil. It requires heating, using a lot of water, heating up the oil to very high temperatures. It's very energy intensive, so it requires a lot of water, it requires a lot of energy, and so it produces a lot of pollution, and it uses up a lot of water. So it's an environmentally much more damaging source of energy, even than just standard forms of oil. So the question that the State Department has to answer is it in the national interest to build this pipeline, to import this oil, to build this connection with Canada, or will the global warming impact of creating a market for that tar sands oil potentially produce more carbon emissions, contribute more to global warming, and ultimately not be in the broader national interest?
Coral Davenport, she's energy and environment correspondent for the National Journal. Matthew Cook, tell us about the company that wants to build this pipeline. What's the business rationale for them?
TransCanada is a Canadian company that is actually an energy company. They're in a variety of different sorts of energy businesses, including building pipelines. And they recognize that not only is there a tremendous resource that, I should say, is actually the extraction and the processes, the environmental processes up there are getting better. And while Coral said, you know, they're very environmentally damaging, that there's a lot of processes have gotten improved. And as we see innovation happen, it's doing a good job at trying to reduce those emissions. But TransCanada saw that there's a market here, and then frankly that this resource is going to get developed in Canada, and they should want to meet the demand for transportation fuels in the United States, and the refineries in the United States are looking for that type of oil to come down here.
What number of jobs is expected?
Yeah, there's been, you know, some discussion about that. I think initially that the estimates by TransCanada have been that there's going to be 13,000 jobs associated with the building and construction, specifically with the building trades. They have an agreement with the trade unions that they're going to provide at least 13,000 jobs. And there's been some estimates of about 7,000 additional multiplier jobs in the communities where the pipeline is going to go through.
For how long?
For the number of years it takes in order to build the pipeline.
Years.
Yes. But then if you go further, Diane, there's and I think it's harder to model, but there's been some organizations have modeled that there's estimates as up to as many as 250,000 jobs that would be associated with not just bringing the oil into the United States and supplying it to businesses in the United States, but also resulting from the benefits of the development in Canada. Our companies, American companies, send a lot of goods and services up to Canada that are being used to develop these oil sands.
Michael Cook, Vice President of the Institute for 21st Century Energy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Turning to you, Michael Brune, from the beginning, there were environmental concerns. Tell us about some. Coral has already raised some. I'd like you to continue.
Sure. So from the beginning, the concerns started with the impact of tar sands development on the landscape, air, water, and local communities. As Coral was saying, the extracting oil from the tar sands is a highly water-intensive and energy-intensive process. Most of the extraction so far has been through strip mining. Basically, you have to move 2 tons of dirt for every barrel of oil that's extracted from the tar sands.
2 tons of dirt.
Right.
For every barrel of oil.
That's right.
All right.
I come from New Jersey, so we like to say that you can fill Yankee Stadium with enough dirt from the tar sands every 3 days, right, just to extract this oil. But lately, as the easier to get oil, you know, the oil that's closer to the surface has been depleted, more of the oil is extracted through in situ mining, which is a case in which natural gas is piped in and then burned to create steam. That steam is then injected into the ground to essentially cook the oil to almost liquefy it enough so that it can be dredged up. That oil is then shipped by pipeline to upgrader, then refiners, and then it's eventually boiled. That whole process of taking natural gas, burning the natural gas to create the steam, and then shipping the oil is highly energy intensive. And as Coral said, it can be up to 37% more greenhouse gas intensive than conventional oil. The process is toxic. There has been water contamination as far as 50 miles away. There's more than 100 square miles of toxic tailings ponds associated with the tar sands development.
I don't understand that.
So the process of extracting the bitumen, the oil from the tar sands, creates a lot of produced water and toxic chemicals, which is dumped into these ponds, holding ponds, for all of this water. The water is so poisonous that the operators have to have booms, these loud noises going off 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to keep the birds from settling on the water. 100 square miles of these toxic tailing ponds. Mines that are so big they can be seen from outer space. But the primary reason, the biggest reason why environmentalists are opposed to this is because it's February of 2013. We just finished a year of record droughts, record wildfires, severe storms, the likes of which we've never seen, a full degree warmer in the lower 48 than we've ever seen in the United States. And this development takes us in the opposite direction of where we need to go. It will increase, it will intensify greenhouse gas emissions at the time when we need to be decreasing them as fast as possible.
Michael Brune, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. We do invite your calls, comments, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. One thing I was interested in, and I'd like you to clarify, Matthew Cook, how much of this oil that would be extracted from Alberta, Canada, and transported to the Gulf Coast would be exported?
Estimates are it's very minimal. I mean, frankly, the reason why they want to build the pipeline to the Gulf Coast is our distribution system and our refining centers are either in the Midwest primarily. There's some in New Jersey where Michael's from, and there's also many in the Gulf Coast. And the distribution network for oil and refined products comes from the Gulf Coast primarily, and a lot of those refineries have been built in order to handle this type of crude. So they want to meet a market. They understand that people here in the United States want to use Canadian products. They want to use this crude that comes down. We have a demand for oil and gas in this country, and we're importing it from other parts of the world. We're importing it from other countries that don't have our best interests in mind. We're importing it from all over the world in ways that aren't as efficient and aren't as environmentally friendly as bringing it in down from a pipeline from a friendly neighbor to the north. So they want to meet the markets here. But it's also a global market. Could there be a chance that they can export some of this crude? Yes. There's certainly fluctuations in markets.
I guess that's the question I've had, because I've heard that 90% was going to be exported. You're saying a very small amount.
I can't imagine any sort of economist would tell you that that's that high.
All right. Matthew Cook. He's vice president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Short break here. We'll talk further and then begin taking your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. We have several emails similar to this one from David in Palm Beach County, Florida, who says, can anyone explain why the nation will derive benefit from allowing Canadian oil from shale to cross our nation to arrive at Gulf Coast refineries so that the resulting byproducts, gasoline, etc., can be sold to foreign nations? Why should our nation take the environmental risk for little, if any, economic benefit? Matthew.
Well, I disagree with a number of those points. I just mentioned that I think there's very little chance that this oil will get exported and any of its products. We have a huge demand here in this country, and that's been recognized. Anyone who since I was a child in the late 60s, early 70s, knows the problems that we've had with importing oil from other places in the world, and here's a chance to import it from a neighbor to the north. But also, the economic benefits are pretty significant. I have acknowledged that you talked earlier about the jobs that benefits just to building the pipeline alone, but there's also tremendous economic benefit right now to the oil sands development up in Canada, and the thought that these resources aren't going to be developed is, I think, a little unfortunate. I think there's also going to be there's an estimated about 80,000 jobs in American workers today that are supplying goods and services up to those developers in Canada because of the good trade relationship we have. So there's a tremendous opportunity here. There's a tremendous opportunity to import that oil and have it come from a country that's nearby, and we avoid some of the economic security issues.
Michael.
Okay, I'd like to take on both points. About the exports, that is a highly disputed statistic that Matthew was using. Most estimates are that at least two-thirds of the oil will come from Canada down the pipeline, splitting the country in two, and then be exported. And if you don't believe the Sierra Club representative, and if you don't necessarily trust the oil industry representative, take what the oil executives themselves are saying. On earnings calls, you've had executives from TransCanada, Enbridge, and other companies talking about how the majority of these oils will be available for export from the Gulf. And then about the jobs, my father is in the building trades for 60 years, right? And so I do think it's important to state that any job is a good job. And it's also important to state that energy investments, any energy investment is going to create jobs. If you have a significant investment in oil or gas or wind or solar. So it's incumbent upon us to think carefully about which investments produce the most benefit for society, which investments produce the most jobs and produce the best jobs. And if you look at study after study after study, what those studies show is that per unit of energy, you'll get more jobs in solar and wind than you will in oil and gas. Those jobs are more sustainable. They're better for society. They help to keep our air clean and cut greenhouse gas emissions, and they diversify our economic base.
Coral.
I do also want to take issue or want to add another set of numbers to the jobs estimates. Matthew correctly pointed out that TransCanada, the company that wants to build the pipeline, has said that it could produce, I think, up to 20 or 30,000 jobs. The State Department, however, which has final approval over whether this is in the national interest, has produced reports saying that the number would be more in the realm of 5,000 jobs. And that would be, the State Department estimates it would be about 5,000 jobs in the two-year period estimated to complete the pipeline. So there really are, you know, there's a spectrum of numbers out there on the total jobs impact.
Why would Canada have to build the pipeline? Why couldn't Canada simply extract the oil coming from those tar sands right there? Matthew.
They don't have the refining capacity right now near where the resources are. And frankly, they're seeing this as an opportunity for jobs and for their economy. They have a economy that doesn't need as much crude oil. The refineries, many of them are further east in the East Coast. And right now, there are already pipelines coming down here. There's a number of pipelines that have been built. We're importing over 2 million barrels a day of oil, both from oil sands and from conventional resources into this country. And it's been a tremendous opportunity not only for Canadians, but for Americans and the American economy and jobs here in the United States.
You know, that is such an interesting point, Michael, that you've got these pipelines all over the country already.
Yeah, so a couple points here. So just to lay this out for your listeners, right now there's about 1.8 million barrels of oil per day being produced out of the tar sands. The Canadian government has approved enough operations to scale this up to 5 million barrels of oil per day and possibly going as high as 10 million barrels of oil per day. If you listen to the comments coming from the oil industry up in Canada, what they will say quite clearly is that they don't have the capacity to absorb that market. So the oil industry in Canada needs a place to sell its oil. That's why this pipeline is coming down. And so for U.S. policymakers, for the president in particular, this is a decision between what is right and what is easy, because we have built pipelines in this country for more than a century. We've built coal plants, gas plants. What should be obvious now is that we can't continue along the same path of development if we want to have a shot at stabilizing our climate, particularly when we have better solutions that will create more jobs, will put more people to work, and cut greenhouse gas emissions at the same time when we invest in solar and wind and energy-efficient technologies.
Coral, do you see that the price of oil in this country could change with the construction of this pipeline?
That's such an important question, Diane, and the answer is no. The price of oil is determined on a global market. So at the end of the day, whether that, if the pipeline is built, whether the majority of that oil stays in the United States or whether it's exported out into the global market. It will add a significant amount of new oil to the global market, but not enough to make a difference in the overall price. It's basically like adding a couple of drops of oil to a bathtub. The global price of oil is determined by everything from, you know, growing demand in China as there are ever more, you know, billions more Chinese enter the middle class and become drivers. It's determined by, you know, what the geopolitics are in the Middle East, in other countries that produce oil. There are so many different forces around the world, particularly spikes in demand, that contribute to that global price of oil, and that price is what determines the price that we pay at the pump. So there could be economic and potentially international advantages to approving the pipeline, but Americans, if that pipeline's built, it probably won't make a difference in the price that Americans pay at the pump.
So, Matthew, how much is it estimated that this pipeline is going to cost?
The estimates are we're at about $7 billion for the manufacturing construction.
Now, $7 billion.
Yes. Now, Diane, they've already started to build a portion of the pipeline. As Coral pointed out at the outset, that this is a process that's been going on for a number of years.
And so how far down?
Well, they haven't started working on the part that enters the United States, but the portion of the pipeline that comes from through Oklahoma and Texas that has been built. And that's an important distinction also because it's helping bring American crude oil. There's been a bit of a surplus in areas like Oklahoma that need to get into our transportation network and need to get into our infrastructure. It's now going to, when that's completed, allow some of that crude oil from those portions of the country to get to our refining centers. And that's an important that to understand that investment's already being made and those jobs are already being realized.
So who's going to make all the money from this pipeline?
I think there's a lot of people who make money from the pipeline. I think you would agree. There's not only, the investors in places in Canada, the United States. I think there's a lot of Americans who are going to see a lot of benefit from this. And
who?
There's American workers who are going to build on the pipelines, like Michael's dad and people who did the building trades. I think there's going to be a lot of other businesses in along the pipeline route that are going to benefit from the construction. But in addition, there's going to be a lot of tax revenue that's going to be generated from this pipeline. And small counties. In Tripp, South Dakota, for example, where you have a population of about 5,000 people, when they're seeing hundreds of thousands of dollars over some period of years in tax revenue, it's going to enable them to build new roads and bridges. It's going to enable those people to have new schools.
Tell me, Michael Bruin, what happened with Nebraska and the governor of Nebraska? What happened there?
Sure. Let me just first correct the record to settle things back at home. My father doesn't work on pipelines, and he most certainly would not support a boondoggle such as this. But in Nebraska—
But he was in the building trades, right?
Yeah. Okay. So in Nebraska, we had the Nebraska Governor Heineman, who has been very clear over the last couple of years that he does not want to see this pipeline impact the water supply in the aquifer in Nebraska. And then recently just changed course about a couple weeks ago to give his support. So the governor was opposed to the pipeline before he was in favor of it.
So how did the pipeline get shifted so that the governor could go along with it, Coral?
So the pipeline, the Keystone Pipeline blew up in 2012 it became a presidential election issue. Before that, as I said, it's been in the works for many years. It was something that most Americans probably hadn't heard of. In early 2012, it looked like the State Department was on track to approve the pipeline. And what ended up happening was that a huge group of environmentalists saw this as kind of a lightning rod issue. They saw this as an issue. They told President Obama, if you approve this pipeline, if your administration approves this pipeline, we will withdraw our support from you in the 2012 election. And this is a core part of President Obama's base. They weren't necessarily saying that they were going to vote for Mitt Romney, but they were saying, you know, we're not going to knock on doors for you. We're not going to have that passion for you. We're not going to make phone calls for you. And that's a group that President Obama really needed. And they rallied outside the White House. They had a huge prop pipeline that they wrapped around the White House. Many celebrities came. Daryl Hannah came. She was arrested. This made a big impression on the White House, and it made a big impression on Obama's 2012 campaign advisor. So what they did is they essentially punted the decision until after the election. And the way in which that decision was delayed coincided with concerns that were going on in Nebraska, that the route of the pipeline as it went through Nebraska was going to cut through the Ogallala Aquifer, which is very, very important source of water supply in the Midwest. There was great concern in the state of Nebraska that the pipeline could pollute or contaminate this water supply. So the delay, the way they talked about the delay was they said, we're going to go back, we're going to review this route, and we're going to reroute it. Eventually, that's what happened. They went back. The state of Nebraska, local officials went back, reviewed the whole process of the pipeline in the state of Nebraska, came back, came up with a new route that does not go through the aquifer. And so now the governor of Nebraska, who has been very concerned about this project, has looked at the new route. The state environmental department has signed off on it. And essentially, the governor of Nebraska has said, we're okay with this now.
Carl Davenport of National Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to go back here to the inaugural address. The president mentioned global warming and climate change five times. So what is your thinking as to what Secretary of State John Kerry may or may not do, Michael Brune?
Well, the speech that the president gave in his inaugural was just fantastic, because he clearly laid out that fighting climate change is both a moral obligation that we have to future generations, but it's also an economic opportunity for most Americans, and it's a chance for us to enhance our competitiveness with other countries by investing in clean technologies. So we're confident that Kerry will advise the president, and the president will decide to reject this pipeline, because it's such a clear first test of the president's commitment to actually fighting climate change, and his commitment to moving beyond these extreme sources of energy that we're hearing about.
Matthew, what do you think?
I think it's still hard to determine. I think we've been through a long process. We've been through a number, yes, of different environmental reviews.
Yes.
As the State Department had come out in 2011 and said that this pipeline would have minimal risk, and since that time, they've gone back and changed part of the route to try to make it even less risky, and heard the concerns of people in Nebraska, and went through a process where the president had said he had heard from Nebraska and was concerned. So, it's hard for me to say what's going to happen in this administration. I'm hopeful that they will approve the pipeline. I think there's a lot of jobs at stake, and I think it's also a big signal to American businesses, and also innovation in this country, and technology, and the opportunities to bridge to the future. If we want to have an alternative energy future, we have to get there somehow, and it's not going to happen easily, and it's not going to happen overnight, and it's not an either-or proposition. I think we can develop alternative resources at the same time that we're finding better technologies and better innovations to use conventional energy resources.
Coral, what are the signals you're getting?
The president's speech made it very clear that he is willing to make some tough choices to act on climate change in his second term. He's obviously not going to – it's very unlikely that he will get help from Congress. I don't think that any of the big moves he's going to make on climate change are going to be with the help of Congress. It's in partisan gridlock right now. He's got bigger climate decisions that he can make than the Keystone. Right now, environmental groups are pushing the president to use his executive authority to enact, through the Environmental Protection Agency, a very aggressive rule that would force coal-fired power plants to cut their carbon pollution today. That is a controversial rule. The president will have the authority to use it. It will have big political pushback. It will also have tremendous environmental impact.
Are you saying that you believe or you think that John Kerry will recommend to the president that the Keystone Pipeline be approved?
My guess is that they want to expend their political capital on get the biggest bang for the buck in terms of climate change. They want to they want to make the biggest climate move they can, and that's going to be through these EPA rules. The Keystone Pipeline is highly symbolic, but it's not going to have as much of an impact on climate change as these EPA rules. So I would guess that there's a chance that they might approve the Keystone and move forward on these even more controversial EPA rules.
Michael, what about that?
Well, so I think really what is the heart of the controversy here is this a political problem, or will the administration look at this as a policy challenge? If it's a political, if they view this through a political lens, then it's really unclear what the administration will do. But if the administration primarily wants to fight climate change effectively, then we won't see piecemeal approaches in one policy traded off for the other.
Michael Bruhn, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Short break, your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Apted, the director of 56 Up, the eighth in a series of documentaries that has followed the lives of several British men and women every 7 years, beginning when they were 7 years old. Also, we talk with Rebecca Luker about her new album of songs by Jerome Kern. She starred in Broadway revivals of Showboat and The Sound of Music. Join us.
And welcome back. We are in this hour talking about the Keystone XL pipeline originating in Alberta, Canada, proposed for construction down to the Gulf and some to be determined for export, some to be used for U.S. purposes. We've got lots of callers. I'll try to get to as many of your calls as I can. First to Mount Vernon, Washington. Good morning, Patrick.
Yes, good morning. I love your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to bring up the comment that recently Canada had sold the rights to the oil sands to China. So we're not even really talking about dealing with Canada in this instance. We're talking about dealing with China, and so I guess it's a international security issue as well.
Coral,
China is very interested in investing in oil sources all over the world, and the reason is growing demand. I mean, as I said earlier, we're going to see in the coming decades billions of new Chinese middle class who are going to start driving China is trying to get its hands on as much oil as possible. And so one of the possibilities is if this pipeline isn't built, it has been discussed that maybe China would build a pipeline to its west coast potentially for export to China. China, there's no question that no matter what happens, China is interested in getting as much, you know, getting access to as much oil from wherever it can as possible.
So what kind of a difference would that make to the construction companies, for example, if Canada built toward the Pacific and sold to China?
Well, I certainly think it's a big signal, and it's something we've talked about in the past that, right now we're the main market for this oil sands, the United States, and as this pipeline is the Keystone Pipeline has taken time to get developed, and the permit process has taken a long time. The Canadians have started to look to build this pipeline west. They see the opportunity to sell to places like China and other places in the Pacific Rim, and they see a demand there. And as was mentioned, the Chinese are very interested in what's going on. They've made some investments in wanting to ensure that those resources continue to get developed so that they get into the supply of the world market.
Matthew, how do you address the climate and land and water concerns that have been raised in this discussion and certainly in various discussions?
Right. There was, some comments made about how dirty this oil is. And I think there's, to help set the record straight, this resource can be as low as 5% more greenhouse gas intensive than current crudes that are developed some places similarly to California or Venezuela or other parts of the world. And as we've gone through the process of developing these resources over the last few decades, things have gotten better. There's been innovations that utilize less energy in order to develop the resources. This in situ method that Michael mentioned earlier has a smaller footprint, environmental footprint, than the mining of the oil sands. And they're finding ways to become even more efficient. They're using less water. They're finding ways to reprocess on-site some of the heat and some of the cogeneration that happens and create efficiency. So the footprint's getting better. And it's all part of, I think, of how the energy systems work and how people are looking to set goals to, if you want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we have to have a bridge to the future. We have to have a way to find that alternative energy future. And in the meantime, let's continue to innovate in not only the alternative energy sector, but in the conventional energy sector.
Michael Burrett.
Yeah, I think to say that the footprint is getting better is a very creative way of describing the project. Let's be really clear and honest with ourselves here. The emissions from the tar sands tripled from 1990 to 2010. They will double again from 2010 to 2020. And the fact that we're arguing about how much worse the tar sands is than conventional oil as a way of describing that the tar sands maybe not be that bad just shows how crazy this project is. So the International Energy Agency last year estimated that if we're to keep warming at 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, if we want to keep warming at that level, which is pretty risky considering the damage we've seen with an increase of only 8.8 to 0.9 degrees of warming so far, if we're going to keep warming at that level, two-thirds of all of the oil, all of the coal, all of the gas around the world that we know about has to stay in the ground. Two-thirds of known reserves have to stay in the ground if we're going to limit warming to a very risky level. So in that context, why would we be building out one of the dirtiest, most carbon-intensive forms of oil in the world? Why would we be sinking $7 billion into a pipeline when that money is much better invested in energy-efficient technologies, solar and wind instead?
All right.
It'll put more people to work, and it'll stabilize our climate.
Let's go to Fort Worth, Texas. Good morning, Leslie.
Hello, Diane, Carl, and Michael, and Matthew. I would just like to comment. There was, on the environmental part and environmental groups, there was a chief of the Cree Nation there in Canada, Chief Teresa Spence. She just came off of about a 40-day fast trying to get a meeting with the prime minister and the governor to speak about the concerns of the First Nations of Canada about the environmental impact that it would have, and also they overrid their own constitution to see that this pipeline is going to go through there. The constitution involves number 45 and number 38 of that states that they would give the First Nations input on any changes, environmental changes that would involve the Indians there. And then it started a movement called the Idle No More movement, in which I was able to go to one of the round dance rallies here in Dallas, Texas, at Dealey Plaza, where JFK was assassinated there. And the point was pretty well heard throughout the nations, throughout the American Indian nations, and then throughout the world. Also, I'd like to comment that in our own religion, the Lakota religion, that's what tribe I am, the white buffalo calf woman said that white man would make a decision, and then that decision could be good or it could be bad.
All right, sir. Thanks for calling, Michael Brune. The decision is affecting a lot of people, not only in this country, but in Canada as well.
Yeah, it is. You know, and I want to thank the caller for mentioning the Idle No More movement, which really has been inspiring to so many people throughout North America and around the world. Native people in the U.S. and in Canada have really borne the brunt of most of energy development in this country and up north. And I think that that's why this issue arises. It brings up so much passion in people on both sides, because we really do have a choice right now between different technologies and a choice between different patterns of development. And those choices, whether they're coal plants or oil pipelines or solar and wind investments, really do impact not just the people working in those industries, but all of us and the quality of life that we enjoy. And that's why there will be, you know, tens of thousands of people here in Washington, D.C. on February 17th, the Forward on Climate Rally, which should be the largest rally in U.S. history on climate issues, because people are hungry for solutions. They are desperate for leadership, particularly here in Washington, and they are working very effectively at the grassroots level to advance those solutions. And we need to see our leaders in the White House and in Congress begin to respond to that, to
all
that
right.
passion.
And here's an email. Please be aware of the fact that First Nations tribes in British Columbia, Canada, are refusing to permit the pipeline to cross their lands. They are opting out the potential jobs and see the pipeline as a threat to their traditional way of life, including possible damage to their lands and fishing. So, Matthew, clearly, on the ground, the people themselves have great concerns about this.
There's processes in place in Canada. They certainly have a regulatory scheme like we do here in the United States that has to provide for input from different tribes and from different states. You know, certainly the British people in British Columbia, including those tribes, have spoken up recently and said they wanted to know more about what's going on and what's going to happen if this pipeline gets built. And I think that's all part of the permitting process. And I think the Canadians have a pretty rigorous environmental scheme. They're known for having a very good regulations in place. And I think that's all part of the process.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Willard.
Oh, Diane, thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
When I was in college, I took a course in economics, and one of the topics we discussed was the law of diminishing returns. And I think that this pipeline business is a perfect example of it. You have to bring the oil down from Canada. It won't flow through the pipeline. You have to pump it. Now, how many pumps are you going to use? Hundreds of pumps? How are you going to fuel the pumps? You can use electricity. You can use wind power, and this takes energy from the national grid and makes electricity more expensive. Probably the best way is to use gasoline to fuel the pumps, and so you will bring the gasoline down, refine it, fuel the tanker trucks go up the pipeline
All right, so the question becomes, how much is it going to cost to get that oil from Canada down to the Gulf?
It's going to be, you know, there's two parts or a few parts you can talk about. One is the cost of building the pipeline, and two,
right,
is, he's right, you do have to put pumps on the stations,
you
and
bet.
And but there's some additional benefit to that. I think there are parts of the country, and we have heard as I've traveled around and the parts where the pipeline will be built, from communities that don't have the benefit of having electricity for manufacturing and for light manufacturing come into those communities. And when this pipeline's built and they have to build some parts of the grid in order to help enhance it and able to operate those pumps, that's enabling some additional benefit, economic benefit to those communities. And it only also, I think, points out some of the other problems that we have with infrastructure and in trying to develop resources in this country. We were speaking earlier about wind development and solar development and projects around the country, not just coal projects and not just oil and gas projects are all being delayed and stopped because of problems with permitting and problems of trying to understand what it means in order to bring energy to all parts of this country. And I think that's something that has to get recognized. And
Coral, any estimates on how much the cost is going to be?
I mean, traditionally, my understanding is that pipelines are actually pretty efficient, the most efficient way to move oil, to move liquid fuels. It's actually a lot less expensive to move oil through a pipeline than it is to put it on a truck or put it on a barge and move it. But all of this is going to go to the State Department and go to, you know, our brand new Secretary of State, Secretary of State John Kerry, who has made climate change for whom climate change is a passionate personal issue, who has devoted a huge amount of his Senate career to working on climate change issues. And really, it all comes down to looking at what's in the best national interest.
Coral Davenport of National Journal, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Indianapolis. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I was wondering why we don't build, instead of shipping it 1,600 miles, why don't we just build the refineries in North Dakota and refine the oil there?
What do you think?
There have been some plans to try to build refineries in, up in that part of the country. One is to satisfy the growth and that's happening in the development of oil and gas up there. But trying to get a refinery built in this country has been much harder to do than try to get a pipeline built.
Why?
It's a very expensive proposition. It costs billions and billions and billions of dollars. The permits, there's a lot of permits required for it. And frankly, as we were talking earlier, our country's becoming more efficient. We're utilizing with projections about CAFE standards and vehicle miles being traveled. We're going to be using less oil, the expectation is, at some point in the future. So when you go to your investors as someone trying to build a refinery and say, I need $3, $4, $7, $8 billion to build this, but the margins and profit are very marginal, and the expectation is that the market's going to shrink a bit, it's hard to attract some of that investment, and it's going to be hard to get it built. It's going to take years and years and years to try to get it
Michael.
Built.
Tom, it's a great question. The reason why the pipeline would go all the way down to the Gulf is so that the oil can be exported. You know, what Matthew was saying.
Now we'll have to discuss that. That's just not true.
I'll finish my answer. But what Matthew was just saying is that the economy is becoming more efficient. We now will soon use 3 million barrels of oil less per day because of these efficiency regulations, which the chamber opposed. Once the heavy duty truck regulations go through, we'll save another 400,000 barrels of oil per day. I suspect the chamber will oppose that as well. As our economy is using oil more and more efficiently, we don't need to get another million barrels of oil coming down from Canada when clean energy will do a better job. So the whole reason, and if you don't believe me, listen to what the oil industry executives are saying, listen to what the pipeline operators are saying. Most of this oil will go all the way down to the bottom of the country and then be exported to foreign markets.
But does that make sense for Canada? Why wouldn't it have built another route?
Because Canadians don't want that route. So there are two pipelines that have been proposed going to the west. One is the Enbridge Northern Gateway, and the other one is the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Both of them are stalled. Neither of them are expected to be built at least for the next 10 years.
Because
of opposition from communities in British Columbia. The premier in British Columbia has now put up significant roadblocks and has called a timeout for several years on that pipeline. So those pipelines will not get built anytime soon. There are also two pipelines that are being proposed to go to the east. Neither of them are going forward yet, again, because of intense opposition in Quebec and in northern New England. So what we have here is an oil industry that is landlocked, that is desperate to find markets for its oil and is increasingly finding it difficult to do so. And again, I'll remember, two-thirds of this oil has to stay in the ground. That's why environmentalists care about this issue so much, because we can't expand a carbon-intensive oil source and cut greenhouse gas emissions at the same time.
And that's got to be the last word from Michael Bruhn. He's executive director of the Sierra Club. Matthew Cook, vice president at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And Coral Davenport, energy and environment correspondent for National Journal. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. Natalie Yerv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.